My name is Edward Champion, and you're listening to the Bat Segundo Show. Norman Rush, well, to say that he needs no introduction is a cliche, and given that the conversation we had is very long, very encyclopedic, not unlike Norman Rush's novels, I don't know if I can actually use cliches, and yet I can't really figure out a way to introduce him. So I'm just going to go ahead and say, here is Norman Rush. Welcome to the Bat Segundo Show. This was a great experience. Enjoy. Okay, so I am here with Norman Rush, who is most recently the author of Subtle Bodies. Norman, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. The way you feel in any reviewing season, which is just getting underway.
Okay.
So I have my... I have my forebodings, but they're under control.
You were showing me, I'm curious about this, you were showing me these series of Venn diagrams that represents your existential view. I'm amazed you could fit this all on one paper.
Well, I'd need a much larger piece of paper to get the whole thing on. This is about current feelings about the way the world is going.
Oh, are they negative or positive?
Well, they are... I'd say it could be described as apocalyptic, but in a piecemeal way. I'm not looking for a big bang, but I think serious trouble is coming.
Yeah.
And I'll explain what I mean by that in describing a kind of lack of fit between what the evolved political institutions of our advanced capitalist republic can deal with, and the scale of the problems that are presenting themselves just autonomously outside of anybody's control.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe one way to kickstart this is to probably tie in a sentiment in mating with what is going on in Subtle Bodies. In the early Circe-like part of mating, you have Nelson Dunoon's speech for his Solar Democracy. So, everything we want in a society is what we find brought out in people in the moment of insurrection. Spontaneity, spontaneous hierarchy, they're all exclamation marks after this, self-sacrifice, staying awake all night, working until we drop, audacity, camaraderie, the carnival behind the barricades. Well, in Subtle Bodies, you have this compound called The Veil. It's a sprawling place. It's just outside Kingston. It's the home to activists. It's reminiscent in some ways of the Martello Tower at the very beginning of Ulysses. And in fact, you even compare it to the Winchester Mystery House. As a South Bay guy, I got that little reference.
Oh, you're South Bay.
So my question to you is, well, based off of what you just were expressing earlier, to what degree was this your way of exploring a sort of Vico cycle in which America is caught within a perpetual moment of insurrection?
Well, that's very acute. This is about really the one of the last flashes of the revolutionary impulse to make a significant change. In this case, stopping the impending invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
So it's not about making a new society in the old sense, in the way that Dunoon was talking about. But it's about a much more reduced, yet still large, objective, and that is basically a negative one, but stopping something from happening.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that Iraq war protest in 2003 is often forgotten by many of the people, like Occupy crowd. I mean, there were regular people who attended these series of protests, and it's kind of been swept under the dustbin of history. I mean, is this one of the motivations to explore this in fiction?
Absolutely, and in fact, it was the largest international demonstration in history. All countries, all over the West, not only here. And it represented a kind of high watermark of emotion left over from the Vietnam War, which had become, in the minds of oppositionists, had been stopped by exactly this kind of direct action mass protest. And of course, well, I don't want to give away the end of the book remind people too much about the history of it, but yes, and that's another thing. I think that the book is working with a kind of fading historical appreciation of what the last 20 or 25 years have really meant.
Well, let me ask you something. I mean, if societal ideals, as are represented in that Del Noon speech, if they are constantly replenishing themselves in this sort of new musk of want, you know, what is the present state of revolution? How can fiction provide an answer or even encourage or empower people to commit revolution?
Don't hold back from the big questions. Yeah. I mean, that is the question. There is every serious writer is implicitly or explicitly asking that question. What does this have to do? What is it that I'm writing about? What does it have to do with the seemingly autonomous evolution of increasingly less propitious circumstances to make change in? And the answer to that is the central and most compelling question, it seems to me, for people who write novels which incorporate serious politics and political thinking into them. And the answer keeps revealing itself as you write and as things change. I mean, one of the things that seems to be happening is that, and one reason that this is such a fascinating and in a way dumbfounding moment is that the three great propositions about how we should organize the world and life, that is to say, socialism, followed by its variant, social democracy, and then followed by neoliberalism, have all in their own ways collapsed and have not, don't exist as real options anymore. They carry on, there are shells, there are people, there's a shell of socialism existing in pockets and enclaves around the world. There's a kind of zombie social democracy operating in mostly in Western Europe. And there's neoliberalism, which is in a state of what you'd have to call a dispensational crisis, because the basic problems like inequality have not been solved.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, coming from the outside is this the continual costs in the environment of the systems we built.
Yeah. But at the same time, Marxism has a lowercase m in mating. And so, you know, has there ever really been any sort of credence to any of these particular systems? I mean, why do we continue to gnaw at them if they are unimplementable in everyday society?
Oh, sure. And actually, the ongoing collapse of socialism, the socialist project.
Yes.
One of the standard responses to that, and it's happened in the past many times, is to take the socialist idea and incorporate it in tiny pieces, just tiny little enclaves, tiny little, make it work, make a pilot model, make it tiny, make it small. That's sort of what De Noon is up to.
I wanted to also talk with you about how space functions in your books. In Mating, you have this wonderful passage where Karen describes love as moving from one room or apartment to another, and each subsequent room and apartment is bigger and better. And also, we learn in Subtle Bodies that the veil's large space has become sort of unwieldy, especially when you're trying to snag some yogurt for breakfast.
Yeah.
But what you just said about how America is kind of compartmentalizing itself and social democracy is doing that reminds me very much of the episode where Nina enters this closet.
Yes.
And she hears these two men, and you write, she had gained nothing by putting herself in this predicament. And I'm wondering if this is your wry way of suggesting that sort of figurative space is the only space that we can trust in fiction, in life, or in politics.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it. Actually, this is a case of her burning desire to know everything.
Yeah.
Getting over her, taking over her good judgment. And as a character, she is determined to know everything she can to relieve the unmerited suffering, as she sees it, of her husband in this milieu.
Yeah.
So she puts her nose into everything in the place that they live.
Yeah.
There's the sting.
In Mortals, Ray complains that Afre was one of those words that was vanishing from the language.
Yes.
But in Subtle Bodies, you have Ned almost terrified with the imperfection of the pickup line, you know, such as "I stand here lonely as a turnstile." Nina also says a pleasant despair in the region of the loins, and she claims to be quoting something, but actually you can't place the quote, so one must assume that it's original in some sense. If your books represent in some way a history of the way that Americans express themselves, and I think we can say that they do, I mean, why do you think your characters have moved from preserving word choice to, and of course we have the word games as well, in the early days of these characters, why have they moved from preserving language to being terrified of the original expression? I mean, why is this of interest to you? I'm curious.
I'm interested in the way people express themselves and way what lasts and what doesn't. It's kind of a Darwinian process that has always seemed interesting to me. For example, why now suddenly? Why do we now say that something that is within your competence is within your wheelhouse?
Yeah,
in your wheelhouse. Now, the odd thing about that is, first of all, I don't know where it started, but it certainly has taken over every conversation, and I was unable, and Elsa too, to recall what preceded it. What did we say when we were saying of someone that he was out of his field of competence or in it?
Yeah.
What did we say? Not his line of work? No, that's not quite right. But there is a kind of occlusion of ways of expressing states of being and possibilities that happens. And it's happening faster now because the media are so ever-present and so tightly connected to everything. It happens fast.
Yeah.
But I ask you, what did you say? What did you say before you said, it's not in my wheelhouse?
Not in my purview, I guess? I don't know. I mean, not in my bailiwick or...
purview is not quite right, because this has to do with competence. Bailiwick is closer.
Yeah.
But anyway, ponder it. I don't have an answer myself.
Huh. I mean, this leads me to wonder, like, there is one point in this book where you have a traveling fight occur.
Yeah.
And I had never actually heard the expression traveling fight, and I became so obsessed with that notion of a fight moving from one place to another. And the only place I could really find it online was from a 1970s article in the Montreal Blade.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, you know, this is interesting how they're so determined to use that term, traveling fight, which comes from a place that they're okay with.
Yeah.
And yet, when they're actually trying to riff on their own faces, they're like, they don't want to relive the pleasure of those word games in their early lives. And also, I'm just curious about where you first heard traveling fight, or I'm just, it's just probably...
I can't tell you. I can't tell you. I know that it came up someplace along the way in my life, and I've carried it around as a description.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, when I needed it, there it was.
Yeah. I found an early draft of the plaid underpants moment in Subtle Bodies between Ned and Nina that was published in the Los Angeles Review of Books. What was interesting about this is that the dialogue you have is almost the same, but there's some interesting description in this early draft where Nina is a little bit more willing to judge Ned. The sentences here are, in the 70s, the boys had lived in a jokey plenum. Now a kind of fitful replay was emerging among them, extending even to Carl, who had a brain. And in the book, you've added this passage where Nina describes how she likes the permanent, delicate, subliminal trembling of the room. And this leads me to ask you, I mean, to what degree are you discovering these characters in the early drafts? Has it been your practice to severely cut the degree to which your characters dwell in the past and concentrate on just the present moment that you are bringing to life, at least, you know, in the present as you're writing?
Yeah, that's it. That's part of my struggle against saying everything.
Yeah.
And you may know that the way I've done my proceeded with in the past with books was to write a dossier for each individual character, so that I knew the life of the character up to that point, and sometimes beyond, just for my own reference. That was a helpful way to proceed, but I do more of that in my head now.
Yeah.
Than I used to feel I had to do on paper. I have cut down in favor of moving the action so that I can get to the next big thing.
Well, in terms of carrying something in your head versus writing it down, I mean, you know, why do you think you've always had that sort of pack rat tendency to say everything? I mean, I'm looking here and at the table, you have this massive quite intriguing collection of files. So, you know, why do you think you need to say everything and you need to get it all down? I mean, you know, and how does it work?
I can tell you part of the answer
sure.
to that that I think is true. But there, obviously there's more to it. I think at the very heart of it, of course, it's got to be something like fear of not having, knowing what you need when you need it. But there's on top of that is laid another impulse that I have when I write, and that is, it's a kind of crazed Platonism, because once you start a book and you set up your characters and you set up the situation and you discern the argument that is going to lie at the base of the structure, you, at least I know, I'm speaking for myself, you have a sense that there is a, that this is a copy of a perfect realization. There is a perfect working out, a perfect working out of the plot, a perfect resolution, a perfect rhythm, everything. There is a perfect embodiment, endpoint embodiment of the things that you've set out to say. And where this comes, and that's what I want to do when I set out. And this is all kind of philosophical, more than I like to admit. But I'm looking for something that is like a realization, like, oh, say, Kurosawa gets in Seven Samurai. When you get to the end of the uncut version, when you get to the end of that, you have had fully and absolutely the experience that was intended from the very first scenes of the book to the end. Or the opera, Tosca, or Ravel's Bolero. At the end of it, you have had everything. It has completed itself. And I think it's probably a self-destructive kind of impulse to be subject to, but that's me.
Yeah. Is it something you grabbed from Joyce? I mean, you know,
Joyce is another example. Ulysses is, and that's why there's so much extra stuff in Ulysses, because in his own sort of not completely formed way, he was, I see him as aiming for the same thing, that same thing, and achieving it in Thunder.
Yeah. But you've never really sought out to have Botswana reconstructed from the bricks you laid down in Mortals or Mating.
I thought I would never know enough, really, as a 5-year resident and student of an extremely complicated and interesting culture. I would never know enough to do that. That will be the work of some writer from that country in some time. But I was always very conscious that Botswana was a set in which I was privileged to place my people and my problems.
I was always really curious about how you got to Botswana, because it's almost like a Phineas Fogg story. You know, you and your wife, Elsa, you become co-directors after this debate in 1977 with Sam Brown.
Yeah.
And it's the discussion is apparently about the state of the world.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, this, you know, what specifically were you articulating?
This was an argument about what should happen to draft resistors during the Vietnam War.
Uh-huh.
Whether the... Because they were activists in the Democratic Party, So there was a question, was there going to be an amnesty? There were plenty of the drafters, especially as affected the draft resistors who were in Canada.
Yeah.
And I was for an absolute solution to this by complete amnesty. The war was wrong, they were right, and they should. And so we had a very passionate argument, heated argument about what you can sell and what to the, you know, political way and everything. And we were both pretty exhausted when it was over, and then we got a call from Washington and saying, look, would you be interested?
So you have this anti-establishment stance to get sort of an establishment job.
Yeah, how do you like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very strange. Well, also was in the argument, too, and it was very passionate. And then we went into to do the interviews in the best possible frame of mind,
yeah.
Which was that there was no way they were going to give us this job.
Yeah.
There was just absolutely no chance of it. So it left both of us very insouciant very, very free to say anything we want. And apparently, they liked it, so...
How much of your present life would you say involves just not caring, being carefree, essentially, and just essentially your life has almost happened almost by fluke, it sounds?
In a way, there have been elements of accident in it, yeah. Yes, that's true. It's been a life uneven in many ways, and money was a problem before it got to be less of a problem. So there was always that. It was, but in terms of being intellectually sort of satisfied to be living the life I'm living, that's good. That's been good, and I have at Knopf. I have the most wonderful editor in the world, understands me, and is so agreeable to my oddities as a editee that it makes me very happy.
Oddities such as what?
Oh, an aversion to semicolons.
Oh.
Some sort of recurrent disputes about commas, how many commas you need.
So you really do get out of the comma splices.
Yeah. commas. I would, if it were left to me, I would go further, especially in the representation of dialogue, in cutting punctuation to the bone. I realize that you can't do it because it makes it look like a dog of another breed.
Yeah.
And you lose something. But there is a thing that I do that in a way is a sort of like an overarching thing, and that is getting the music right. I read everything aloud, passages, sometimes I even sing them to myself upstairs. Elsa will think there's a madman in the attic, and she's right. But
what key do you sing them? Do you use any sort of strange, you know, Fergian scales or anything like that?
No, just ordinary folk song.
Oh, yeah.
Folk song singing.
You play guitar?
No.
A banjo?
No,
nothing. Ukulele? Nothing?
Ukulele I used to play when I was a kid, but it just, you know, without any art.
Is singing out your prose kind of the getting it right of last resort, so to speak, or?
It's knowing that it has to have that. You're looking for units of seamlessness, and that things go from one point to another, and that you're not falling into journalism. Journalistic, especially if you're writing about exotic locales and there's lots that you want to convey about it, you want to remain within the realm of art and not fall into expository journalistic tropes.
Huh. So, I mean, to what degree have you resisted the essayistic or the journalistic? I mean, your novels are always encyclopedic. If you're not talking about intellectualizing emotions or emotionalizing intellect,
yeah.
There's something about a Sherlock Holmes pastiche or something along those lines, or just something that we're gnawing upon. And so, you know, what do you do to make sure that,
mean, how much revision do you, does it take? To, I mean, when do you know it's right? You know?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you part of the secret of why the books come out the way they do is that it's in my nature. I want to write the kind of book that I would like to read.
Yeah.
And I want to learn what's at the side as much as I can. What's at the side of the action? I'm an anti-minimalist in a certain way, and I put stuff in the book that is interesting to me. That's explanatory obliquely to the characters and to the action, but the editing problem is not to put too much.
Yeah. But there's also a very specific pace you have. Like, Mortals, the first half is such a... I mean, it's an uphill climb, but in a very bracing way, because you're getting to know the Finches, and you're getting to know the world that they're in. And then when he's out in the Kalahari, all of a sudden it becomes like this, I can't put it down. It's like a page turn. At least it was for me.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, when you're to what degree are you thinking of pace like this, or the reader, or to what degree are you thinking of the reader earning the right to advance at...
Well, I never put it in quite those terms, but there was a deliberate design behind the changes, the change in pace.
Yeah.
And the odd thing about Mortals is that a very a characteristic response in a group of people is that half liked the first part and were uncomfortable in the second part, and another half, usually evenly divided between readers, liked the second part and we're impatient with the first part. So, you know, it's damned if you do and damned if you don't with an overall choice like that. But that was deliberate, yeah.
I'm curious. I know that when you were co-directors with your wife in Botswana, my understanding is that you had to be cost-effective in your cable transmission.
Yes.
And, you know, the more words you used, the higher the tab. Now in this age where you can send unlimited texts, it's kind of odd to think about that, but it's good to remember. What effect has this had on your writing? I mean, was everything you wrote beforehand fairly prolix? Do you have any prolix impulses aside from the caverns of information or the temptation to move into the journalistic these days? Or
she wrote as many or more cables than I did, so I can't claim any disciplining effect of that. It was just part of the job, and I wasn't learning anything I think from that in particular. But the anti-minimalist impulse was force-fed by the absolute otherness of the country and what we were seeing.
Yeah.
So that's where that came from.
So life is more of a effect on, I suppose, what you conveyed too. Huh. I mean, well, since Botswana, I mean, how has life kind of affected your
well,
prose?
Well, the strange thing is that America's crazier than Botswana if you get up close. I mean, right now, at least, that's the way it's feeling to me. It's exotic in its own way. And that's what I'm discovering.
I know that you filled up 3 cartons of notes. You came back from Botswana with 3 cartons.
Yep.
And I also know that you spent 15 years in the antiquarian book business and also filled up notebooks. I mean, why didn't you really have the time to write? Was it really a matter of just not making the time, or was it trying to convey what you were observing in whatever sort of shorthand impulses? What happened?
When I was... I started out writing as a, well, I won't go back into my childhood ventures, but I was writing all the time that I was in the book business. But I was writing, I was going through, working through an experimentalist phase.
Yeah.
And before that, I started out as a mistakenly thinking that I was a poet. So I published little bits of poetry, mostly political poetry on exquisitely unknown incidents in the history of the Western left. Tremendously interesting to me, but not to to anybody else.
Such as what incidents were?
Say something like the proroguing of the Constituent Assembly in Russia, or the failure of the socialist movement to come together on an anti-war platform in 1914. These things hurt my heart.
Yeah.
But it's so parochial, really, as time passes and as the understanding of the meanings of these kinds of incidents touch you, you have to make an adaptation to your place in things, in the swim of things.
Yeah, so it seems to me that you were sort of stubbornly taken with the idea of either being an experimentalist or a poet. I mean, why did the transition take a little longer for you? Why didn't you actually see that illuminating light that, well, you know, I may actually get published or I may actually get read if I adjust things?
It was a slow learning process and a realization that reading other experimental works and discovering that the notion of trying to out-Joyce Joyce was probably not going to work.
Yeah.
People get very crazy. I mean, the whole anxiety of influence business is really true.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to outdo impossible people, impossibly accomplished and grand people, you are probably not taking the right approach to what you want to express.
Huh. But don't you need to have the impossible with which to measure yourself?
Always had that. Yes, I have.
Yeah,
it's still true. Yeah.
So Karen, the anthropologist who does not have a name in Mating until we see her later
in Mortals.
Yes, I mean, she first appeared in your story, Bruins.
Yes.
I understand she is based primarily on Elsa, your wife, and I also partially on the girlfriend of a South African exile you knew in Botswana, Patrick von Rensburg.
Van Rensburg,
apologies. As well as a nutritional anthropologist. You know, at what point did you feel that Karen was free from the shackles of real life experience, from influence? In what ways?
Oh yeah, she becomes increasing. Her adventures both harden and release her. I mean, she's working against, she's an up from under character. She has created herself from out an underclass start by brains.
Yeah.
And that's one reason, for example, that her vocabulary is so extraordinary, because she has figured out that, or maybe over-figured out, that a way up in the world, especially the academic world that she decided to enter, is to have an indomitable vocabulary.
Yeah.
So I mean, she goes overboard with it, but that's part of her character. And it's one of the things that it has taken readers longest to really understand in a friendly way, that I wasn't putting big words into a book because I just love to see readers scurrying to the dictionary.
Yeah.
This was part of the making of the character and the constitution of the character.
Yeah. Well, has that been a problem for you throughout all of your writing, that the accusations that, oh, well, he's just showing off? I mean, how do you tame that?
It's only come up in the case of Karen's vocabulary. That's the only time that's happened.
How much was Karen defined by de Noon? I mean, do you often flesh out characters by giving them someone so indomitable? Is this why you're attracted to couples?
Yeah, that's true. I think the three great subjects for literature are love, work or vocation, and empire.
Yeah,
those are my. My three Moby Dicks. I don't have one. I have three, and the making of a durable kind of bond against the world with another person is a huge subject, and one that, you know, that is, we're not at the end of it.
I wanted to ask you, because I know that you met Anne Close at a dinner hosted by Tom Dish.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how you got to know him. I'm a big fan of his. I was very fortunate enough to talk with him as well.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, he he committed suicide. But I'm wondering how you guys knew each other.
Tom read a story of mine, and called me up and said he wanted to put it in an anthology. He was doing an anthology called Bad Moon Rising.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of flabbergasted. And I said, well, let's, sure, wonderful, let's talk about it. So that was the beginning of a long friendship. And Tom is a very underappreciated writer. He was a genuine man of letters. I could talk to him about anything, call him up, and his breadth of knowledge and his corrosive wit and skepticism were just a joy. Yeah. Made him impossible to deal with on some subjects. If you knew him at all, you know that he was that kind of man.
Yeah.
But he was my great literary friend all my life.
Wow.
And he had told us that he was in terrible trouble, economic, financial, and rental. And he was despairing, and we knew that he was developing suicidal, despairing feelings. And he had promised her that he would not do it, and if he thought he was going to do it, he would call her first. But in the end, he was overwhelmed.
Do you feel that New York is increasingly hostile to men, true men of letters? I mean, is it even possible to have them? We're doing our best in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
but it's not exactly economically feasible, even in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You have to find creative ways to live.
Yeah, I think I paid, when I was living on the Lower East, we were living on the Lower East Side, our rent was $48.88 a month for a large tenement flat, plenty of room. And, but there's nothing like that. I mean, people start paying rent in the thousands.
Yeah, yeah.
Of dollars.
I wanted to discuss, going back to Subtle Bodies, Nina is the first of your protagonists to consider active parenthood. Although there is, of course, Nan in Near Paula, the story in White's. I'm wondering, first off, if Nan and Nina were closely aligned, and as well as this notion of Hume, the son of Douglas, this man who dies, which is why Ned and Nina come up to visit. He is strangely defined in the early parts of the book as sort of a peeping Tom.
Yes.
So, I'm wondering why it took you quite a long time to really approach this notion of parenthood like this. And I'm also wondering if there's any kind of alliance with Nan and in Near Paula.
I hadn't thought of it. It's an interesting idea. Maybe something to that. But the writing about parenthood, I had approached it a couple of times in other works in the earlier novels. But in each case, it becomes unless it's central as a concern, as it is in Subtle Bodies, it becomes a subject in itself, and it becomes a different thing to write about, or a subsidiary thing to write about, at least in terms of my ability to handle it. It came out that way.
What about, subsidiary topics in general? I mean, when you think you're writing about something, I mean, how often do other topics tend to gestate? Like, for example, in Subtle Bodies, I mean, what did it start off being focused on, and what did it end up being? I'm curious.
Yeah, no, it came out to be being about what it was intended to be.
Sure.
But along the way, in this long period of time, it kept threatening, and in fact succeeding in turning itself into a different book about different problems of a more cosmic sort, about thinking about life in the afterlife, if that's what you want to call it, and how people adapt to that. And I came to a kind of realization at the end of it, when I finally got hold of the thing, I had a realization something like this. You have to be very canny how you write. The tale of masculine sadness, the sadness of educated white Westerners, it's been done in different settings, but it has been done. Joyce's Ulysses is an example of masculine sadness and trying to get it right. David Foster Wallace, in a more extreme way, is also about how to be a man, how to be an intelligent and intellectual man under conditions of the threat of addiction that is so prevalent in the society and of personal weaknesses. So
empathic as well.
So I mean, this is well trodden ground.
Yeah.
And if you're going to approach this, it has to be. I mean, the audience for literary fiction is heavily gendered. It's mostly women and members of English departments. I mean, or other writers. I mean, that's really it. But it's largely female, and that's because people go back again and again to novels because they have a problem. And the problems of women have changed utterly in recent times, but they're still there, and they exist in exquisite new combinations. And I think that is that's energizing for that part of the audience that comes to serious fiction.
And yet women continue to respond, especially to mating. In fact, actually, I'm sure you heard the other day that Lena Dunham, of all people, actually tweeted, "Hey, I absolutely love Norman Rush's Mating."
No, I didn't.
She tweeted this, and because there was an interesting New Yorker blog post where someone had compared Adele Waldman's book with Mating about, authors who write narrators from a different gender.
Yeah.
And someone had made this very smart comparison, and then Lena Dunham tweeted it. And so it was
unbelievable. I remember to tell Elsa.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is how your characters are often defined by curious reading allegiances. I mean, in Mortals, Ray Finch is this man desperately trying to catch up on the Times Literary Supplement.
Yeah, something we can all identify with.
Yes. You have Karakang in Mortals constantly on Tennyson.
Yes.
You have the characters in Subtle Bodies, much as in your previous books, also defined this way. Ned and the Economist. And of course, we have the manuscript as bomb in Mortals as well. I'm wondering why reading allegiances like this are so important to knowing the characters. Is it largely because of this reading audience problem you just identified, that it's mainly other writers, English professors, and women? I mean, why is this so pivotal?
No, it's typical of the milieu that they exist in. I mean, these are. I mean, my stories may be the last novels about readers. I mean, people who are readers the way we're readers.
Yeah. Yeah.
They also have book preferences, it's part of their cultural baggage that they come and defining. And when I was growing up, I was always fascinated with. And would make a nuisance of myself by writing things down of what people had on their bookshelves, because those were the days when people had, you wouldn't call them personal libraries, but they had collections of books, and they were often absolutely fascinating and telling about what people were and are.
Yeah, in many ways, what is on a bookshelf is a truer indicator of character than how they look.
Not truer, but part of the whole picture.
Yeah. Well, what's also interesting too is that your characters also seem to be either seduced by quacks or very interested in them. I think of the Sangoma in the story Official Americans, or of course the infamous moral in Mortals that Iris gets hooked on. I mean, why do you think that this is your way of showing that no matter how erudite you may be, at the end of the day, we're all Marx in some way. We will all hypothetically.
It's a danger for everybody, and yeah. I think it comes from my indelible mark left on me by my life experience, my personal history of my father starting out as a complete rationalist political radical, socialist, democratic socialist, but socialist, and he gave me literature to read about the struggle for free thought, and he was a non-religious person, and then he passed through a shadow, and on the other side came out in a succession of religious selves, ending up in theosophy, a variant of theosophy.
Did he end up at a train station like Tolstoy?
No. But it was very confounding to me and left me with a permanent question about... this shows up in all my books to some degree, about the foundational aspects of what you are, what you become,
uh-huh.
and how that... how that's in some way always to be looked at.
So I see. So you, because you saw your father inevitably embracing spiritualism, you know, pretty much that is, I guess, the unavoidable part of being an American, perhaps, that we are going to have to wrestle, perhaps on some level, with either our Americanness, whether it involves
what I call Americanity, which I finally got people to
Americanity.
Yeah,
like that.
Which I was putting it in reviews for years.
Really?
And they would always exit out. They wouldn't take it. I couldn't get it into anything in New York Review of Books or anything. But I'm interested in Americanity, and that's it, because the American civil religion has a little more religion in it than it does have civil.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's what you work with when you talk about Americans, if you get outside of your very enlightened circle of friends.
Yeah. But in Mortals, when Ray burns his passport, he does it in this very fascinating way of, well, you know, I'm doing this because something will happen. And, of course, something does happen.
Yes, yeah.
And that is really remarkably reckless, and yet it's rooted in some kind of, on some level... It's rationalized, even though it's not rational.
You're right.
On some levels,
right.
It's pragmatic. And even though it's not, you know?
Yeah, no, you've caught it completely. It's a kind of divided action, yeah.
Yeah. So that, I guess, is a symptom of Americanity.
Yeah.
Huh.
Because also behind that is this driving optimism, which goes with being, this is sort of, I think, partly deluded, but partly not, optimism that you can come through, that you can do it. It's a strain in the culture. It doesn't affect everybody.
But yeah, well, at the same time, though, we also need optimism in order to actually believe in something, because life would be pretty terrible if it was just nothing but despair.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I'm probably the only person who's going to make this comparison to you, and you may in fact give me a lot of hell for it, but I have to.
No, go ahead.
Subtle Bodies reminded me very much of this recently released movie called The World's End. And The World's End is this movie. It's a wonderful movie, actually. You may actually like it. It involves a group of people who come back 20 years to a small town to relive a pub crawl. And they find that the town is actually taken over by blue-inked aliens.
Oh, and, sounds terrific.
But it actually isn't really about that
genre.
It's
a comedy, right? It's
a comedy, but it's actually sort of a drama. But the thing is, this reminded me of Subtle Bodies because both this movie and Subtle Bodies deal with some kind of an ideologue. In the end, in this case, you have a missing one, Douglas.
Yeah.
Both of them deal with trying to relive past glories, and both seem to be contending with an absence of identity.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, going back to what we were describing earlier about that seminal moment of 2003, whether, just historically speaking, even globally speaking, because it's a British movie, you know, what do you think accounts for this kind of level of anxiety and nostalgia and yearning to relive something that we just are well beyond, that becomes almost unfamiliar in the present?
Yeah, I'll have to look at that movie. It sounds good. here's part of what I do when I write. I like to take, you could call them cultural cliches, say in mating, boy meets girl, in Mortals Triangle, in this book it's a combination of things. It's in Subtle Bodies. It's the 20 years after Big Chill,
yeah,
reunion, meme, English Country House, murders, and a couple of other things. And I like to take those and set on them the structures of the most compelling and important sort. And it gives me pleasure to do it. I mean, I like employing these tropes from popular culture and turning them into the foundations for serious art.
This is your way to adhere life to narrative. You take something that's been well paved over,
oh, yeah,
a trope of some
kind.
Oh,
and Bedroom Farce also, yeah, yeah, goes in, is one of the things that goes, you know, doors slamming and
sure,
people running out
sure,
of bedroom. That's sure, that's a third element in the foundation stone.
Does this just help you to, I guess,
yeah,
provide a structure?
Is it heuristic? Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I wanted to also talk about Rex from Mortals. He's a fascinating character. He's absolutely the type of flailing aspirant writer who is now found today on websites such as The All in Droves.
That's right.
You know, he's desperate to have his wit approved by the public. He is not quite as clever as he thinks he is. He's unable to put together this coherent manuscript.
Yeah.
Strange news. But it's this figure who, oddly enough, Ray has to triangulate his empathy with. He has to find a connection through this dubious method. But and in the end, it comes down to family. But maybe it's not so much family. Maybe it's just about attempt. In Subtle Bodies, we have only scant details about Douglas to work with, but he comes across, despite his accomplishments, in much the same way. He's kind of this middling educated type. We are not quite sure what his achievements are.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering how a figure like Rex and Douglas, how do these aid you as a novelist to sort of reveal these truths about your characters, why someone would be vaguely isolationist?
I don't know exactly what the answer to these. You don't know what kinds of characters are going to bring out your writerly force. But if I had to psychoanalyze myself, I'd say that probably they represent failed forms of myself.
Yeah.
Anticipated but overcome ways that I could have failed in the past, knowing my weaknesses and knowing my inclinations. I think it's something like that.
Is it harder to summon up failure when you've had a fairly successful writing career? Or?
No, easy.
Easy.
So you're falling off a log.
Yeah.
Falling off a log. I consider that the number of accidents that on which I fell on the lucky side of the line that led me to be able to continue writing, to give up experimentalism, for example, to emerge from that extreme experimentalism, and to leave behind a period of time when people were saying, I have friends who worked in this kind of sensibility, that, oh, writing books. Books are about the language.
Yeah,
books are about the language. You can do anything. I escaped it. I don't think I was really in danger of going there because I was looking for something else in experimentalism. But that became the kind of cliche, dummy experimentalism. And to me, it's like saying, oh, the play is about the costumes,
yeah,
or the props. I mean, nonsense. Really, fundamentally nonsense. But I mean, there were many. Elements in my life that where I came out lucky.
How do you? I mean, do you need a certain amount of unlucky moments in order to keep that tension going at all?
They come on their own. Yeah. I don't have to look too hard for them. There's life presents you with all kinds of tough news,
pratfalls,
strange news. Yeah.
I wanted to also talk about these three cartons of notes and how the details from them accreted themselves into these books. I mean, I'm wondering, first and foremost, you know, obviously you couldn't use all of it, but how much did you try to use?
Yeah.
How much did you not use? Were there certain areas that you
really
wanted
to? Yes, and in fact, there were sections, for example, in Mortals.
Yeah.
There was a section I cut at the encouragement of my wife and my editor, a long section about the Tsodilo Hills and a very fascinating and peculiar cave art, going back questions of dating, who did it, what it meant, and all that. Well, you can't put everything. Although I would like to put everything into it, I had to cut that. I would say I've still got, if I'm honest about it, I've still got about a third of what I brought back that would be possible for literary exploration. I don't think I'll do it though. But
well, this leads me to ask a fairly obvious question, but one I'm curious about nonetheless: why not Botswana for Subtle Bodies?
No, it never occurred to me. And I was also thinking the way things work out in Africa between expatriates, and these would have had to be expatriates of one sort or another, it's different than the way things work out in America between citizens and residents. Just different.
Yeah.
There is a kind of simplification of character and a movement toward the extremes of character that occurs in a discombobulating setting of a foreign country run by black people. I mean, it's just different. So,
I wanted to actually follow up on something James Wood has pointed out about your books. And he pointed it out specifically in relation to Mortals, where he notes that Ray's interpretation of the dead, that women have ruined everything, is identical to what Gabriel Conroy thinks.
Yeah, okay,
and,
yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, this courage to inhabit an unseemly perspective, to have a narrator who's going to use a word like hellmouth.
Yeah.
Is this the kind of thing that the writer should take away from reading? Is this what it's all about? The idea of just, you know, perspective is really, I guess, the gift that is the way that things are paid forward, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's a very good way of putting it. Yes, and I actually, to think about that was one of the you know, if you look back and think, what are your pinnacle reading experiences when you're a kid, growing up, and what are the things that you read that throw open to you the idea of what you're going to accomplish in literature? It would be the dead would have been one of the great migrating. I don't know if you feel the same way. I mean, everybody agrees that it's a great story, but it's not only a great story; it is a supremely great story and with supreme resonances for writing. And yeah, it had a huge effect on me. I hadn't thought about that, but that's very interesting.
Huh. I mean, did you do anything like that with either Karen or Ned and Nina at all? Was there any particular perspective that you drew upon to kind of get the perspective on the page a little
Nothing conscious, no. I mean, it's just, but I mean, my mind is such a midden of reading. When I was in the antiquarian book business, that was books of history mostly, and social science and so on. I had a tick. I couldn't sell a book unless I had taken a look at it and tried to see what I was giving up, giving away, selling, putting into somebody else's hands. So,
did you have like 6 or 10 volume sets?
You'd be surprised at the things that I scanned.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't read but you can scan, and some I read. But it was a personal weakness. It's not you can't be a successful bookseller if you get stuck with something like an interest like that.
Yeah. So what kinds of, aside from social science and history, what else did you read and when you were in the antiquarian business?
Well, I read everything. Ethnography. I've always been, you know, in another life, I think I would have been Karen's boyfriend.
Yeah.
And going out someplace. Always a fascination for me. Along with the other usual reading that you do.
You said in a Paris Review interview that you wanted to do fiction with numbered paragraphs ever since you read Hume. Well, you got your wish here with Subtle Bodies, and you have the kid who is named Hume. You know, why did it take so long for this desire to germinate into an actual book?
It was a question of well, having people willing to have a book organized in that way. I mean, I had enough clout that I could say this is the way I want to do it. And also, it's alternating points of view. The first of my books that has alternating points of view, and rather a linear point of view from either male or female. So, yeah, a couple of novelties there. It was just lucky, I guess.
Not having that sort of sustained perspective, I mean, what trade-offs did you have to make in terms of expansiveness to, you know, I mean, obviously, I guess there's more of a poetry involved with that.
Yeah, there is. It's more. It gives you more of a lyrical. See, this is a chamber. This is a chamber work, and it's supposed to be movements all in the same key to the end. And so that's what I aimed for.
I wanted to talk about the Kalahari Desert, which is a moment of transformation for both Karen and Ray. In Karen's case, she must walk across it, and then, of course, she reaches Sao and Danun. Ray, of course, finds Moral there in Mortals. I'm wondering what it is about that whole desert crossing that appealed to you. I mean, two different forms of, I guess, a spiritual awakening. I'm wondering why there wasn't sort of a desert moment or something akin to that in Subtle Bodies. What's your experience been with the Kalahari?
The Kalahari is a physical. Well, it is just the physical experience itself.
Yeah.
Two things about it. One, that it is so overwhelmingly itself and so forbidding and so tough. And at the same time, there are people who are living lives under the most, what would seem to be the most, exacting is the wrong word, impossible situations, and living with a certain intentness and apparent joy and equanimity. That was all to be put together for me. I just had to get as close. I'm no closer really to figuring it out now than I ever have been. I can only report. I'm a reporter on that. This immense solitude, people living in it, and events happening like dust storms so intense that you are, I think you'll never come out of them, coming up and going away. Fires. Odd behaviors of animals. I mean, all of it is just so overwhelming that was what it was.
So you needed to be overwhelmed with life you weren't regularly acquainted with in order to broaden your view as a novelist.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
How do you? What other life do you see these days? You know, the last couple of decades or whatnot.
Yeah. Well, I'm living a. Living in the country and where we have lived for a long time. I mean, really, 40 years, 45 years. And seeing that change around us, too.
Do you raise stately, plump black turkeys at all? Or?
We don't have to. We have wild turkeys and wild quail and the occasional red fox and deer. Where we are. It's part of an undeveloped state park where we have an old house.
One of the curious aspects of Subtle Bodies is that these characters describe the landscape around them often through movie comparisons, which is interesting because we're now inarguably in cinema's waning years. We don't know how it's going to transmogrify, but it is something that is curious. It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about how your characters in Subtle Bodies seem to have this aversion to
their own original phrases and all that. But it is interesting that there's this kind of scavenging quality to them as well. And I'm wondering, you know, if this reflects kind of what you've seen more with younger people.
To some degree. And also there is, even in slightly older people, there is this sense that movies are benchmarks in a different way. I mean, when I went to the movies, it was for fun, you know. Yeah. And you see cowboy movies, Randolph Scott. went regular to the Fairfax Theater. But movies became more iconic. Maybe starting with Kazan or something.
Yeah.
For people, I mean, there was something new about the. I think that's fading now too. But for this particular slice of a generation of people, it was movies, and it was there's kind of a messianic quality to certain of the great stars of the time, Brando being one, that affected men and women alike. Yeah. And I wanted there to be ripples of that showing in the characters.
Well, if the movie industry is decaying and people are sort of sporadically reading literature, I mean, you know, what's the future of narrative? We're still going to need stories. We're still going to need to feed these impulses to make sense of the world around us.
You can't do without the stories. I don't know. I find it's a kind of a chaotic situation.
Yeah.
And not at all clear how it's going to turn out.
I wanted to actually, I mean, we haven't really talked about the balance between the personal and the political, which is in all of your books. The sense I get, especially with this last book, is that if you ratchet up the political, all of the personal metaphors you make about your emotions or your inner life are going to become unmanageable. I mean, it seems to me that balance is what guides most of your characters. Is it safe to say that the political is more dangerous than the personal?
Yeah, both dangerous, but in a certain way, yes. And also the aspect of the political of getting it right, not to be a fool.
Yeah.
Not to be a to recognize the evils of the world and know that you have an obligation, some way to express yourself against them, but not to be a fool, not to be taken in, not to be taken over, and that's like a rotary. It keeps changing. The options keep changing, but the problem doesn't go away.
Well, what do you make of this digital age in which we're all inclined to be easily duped by an unconfirmed tweet or by some sort of fake story? I mean, now it's the point where major newspapers, also in decline, are also believing much of this and not actually following up and doing due diligence. It's frightening.
I think it's absolutely an unreadable future. An unreadable future. I don't know. Sometimes I think it'll all sort out. Other times, I think that the weighting of what the net culture does is negative and dangerous. Other days, I'm happier. I mean, I can feel, you know, something good happens and it's connected to that. And one thing, of course, that's happening is that the net has enabled people to organize demonstrations on an extremely large scale and in very short time.
Yes.
That has to be important. Where it goes and what the political content of the demonstrations and the objects of the demonstrations will be is an open question.
So maybe social democracy has a future, despite the fact that it's an unreadable one.
Maybe so. Yeah, that's a possibility.
Well, that seems a good note to end. Norman, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Well, it was a great pleasure to chat with you, and your questions are excellent and provocative.